This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're talking organization. Not mise en place or keeping your knives in a row, but labor organizing.
If any restaurant worker is listening to this and is like, yes, I want something different, but I don't know where to start. First step they just need to do is to find one of us and get plugged in.
As independent contractors, they can't directly tell people, you know, when or where to work, but by using sort of gamified nudges to push people, that is sort of how they move the workforce around.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief with your hosts, me, Zara Tangora.
And Bobby Conforto, your mama.
Hey, mama, how are ya?
I'm okay, Zaz. Still stuffed up. I keep saying that every week.
I mean, those spring allergies here on the East Coast are really tough. I have friends who live in Portland, and they talk about how on the West Coast, but particularly the Pacific Northwest, I think allergies are like even worse. So, you know, they're difficult everywhere. Mm. I was with one of my best friends, Becky, last night, and she was having allergies, but it was triggering a cough. And we like had just sat down to have a drink at a bar, and she's like coughing and coughing. And like, you know, it's still COVID times and people don't want to hear you cough. And like, you want to just hold up a sign and be like, it's just allergies. But anyway, so today on the show, wow, what a show today. I feel so lucky that we get to, I feel lucky when we talk to new people for a whole different set of reasons, but I feel lucky that we have people in our sphere, in our community, in our friend circles and our families that are willing to come on and talk to us. And today is one of those really special episodes where we get to talk to a very close member of our friend slash family, Mary Beth White. And Mary Beth comes on, and we're, you know, the show today is really largely about funeral traditions, which I feel like this is a part one, right? Like,
yes,
I agree. Such a topic. I mean, I, you know, did a very brief kind of summary of different funeral traditions from around the world, which I would love to really delve in more deeply with people from those cultures at some point. But we, you know, we wanted to kind of start opening up the conversation about funerals. We had touched on funerals a couple of times with a couple of guests. We spoke about, you know, with Shiva, with Peter Shelsky, with Risa, about her in-home funeral, which we reference in this show. But it was really interesting to dive into it in this way with Mary Beth. And just a little bit about Mary Beth. She, as she mentioned, started with hospice, but she has a really expansive career in women's health as a nurse practitioner and as someone who is just always learning about different kind of holistic things. And she's a brilliant person and a funny person and a serious person. And one of the things I want to say about Mary Beth, that the word that sticks out to me most, she's very thoughtful. She's very thoughtful in the way she speaks, and she's thoughtful in her mannerisms, and she's just a thoughtful person and a lovely person.
And very tender as well.
Yeah.
And, when she mentioned, she referenced before her salons, I was always so impressed because salons is a concept, I don't know how many years ago they used to do it, but it was the intellectual community would gather in the living room and talk about subjects of meaning and depth. Mm. And she began a whole series of salons here. Mm. I don't know how many she had, but again, she was taking all the kinds of things that she was exploring and the curiosity that she has and the wisdom that she brings to it. And she would share that with people and have guests in her salons. In a way, she was doing what we're doing, but in her living room.
Yeah, and I want to just mention to that point that there are so many ways in which folks do that in ways that maybe are not, you know, defined as a salon, but just as, you know, even being in an actual salon, you know, like a bunch of women or men or people, folks just around in a salon, like chatting about life and about philosophy, but not necessarily under that pretense. And it's just, it's something that we all do in our own very special ways and in trying to unpack the meaning of life, intentionally or unintentionally, but we do it so constantly as people. And I think it's beautiful the way in which Mary Beth has done it so intentionally. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's beautiful to see, you know, folks hanging around in the park playing chess and doing that. So, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. To all of you trying to unpack what it all means, power to you. It's a, mm-hmm. it's an important feat. Well, what a great episode, and I can't wait for everyone to listen to it. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous day today, and has been a bunch of gorgeous days. And what has been a really beautiful spring here on the Northeast, and seeing all the flowers and the warm weather and the sunshine, and it's been healing. And I feel like there's little glimmers of hope kind of arising in terms of life getting back to normal, and I think it's feeling good. Over here.
And again, we talk about this in many of our shows, that it's just opening up to those moments. Life may be difficult for you now listening. You know, mm-hmm. it's difficult for all of us in different ways at different times, but it's okay to just appreciate that little moment of the sun shining or the flower growing, or.
And then get back to feeling like shit if you need to. Really? Yeah. You know what
yep.
I mean?
Yep.
So if you're feeling like shit, but you saw a beautiful flower, or you got warm from the sun today, that's okay.
Both so, at the same time. Take care, everyone.
Without further ado, please enjoy our interview with Mary Beth White. Thanks. Right, so we are joined today by a very dear friend of our family and wonderful person, Mary Beth White. Mary Beth is a women's healthcare nurse practitioner, advanced practice holistic nurse, transpersonal nurse coach, and former hospice nurse whose interest in non-traditional funerals and green burials was inspired by caring for her mom and family at the end of your mom's life. Mary Beth. That is quite a list of credentials. You are such an impressive person, and you are also within our community, I feel like, the healer who we all turn to whenever we have a question about anything, you know, whether it be like gynecological health or just an ache or a pain or a heartache. You're such a wise healer and wonderful person. So welcome to the show, and it's our pleasure to have you.
It's wonderful to be here. My pleasure. And it does feel like family day, so... Yay yeah. for us.
I know. And so your kid is my best friend, and it happens to be their birthday today. So it is such a wonderful kind of happening that we all get to be together on Happy Dan's Birthday, as we have dubbed it.
So happy shout birthday. Shout out to Dan. Happy birthday, Dan. Happy birthday, we love Dan. You.
So today we are going to talk a bit about, this is a really special episode because we want to talk a bit about funerals. And I think each of us have something kind of different we want to say about funerals that comes from our own place of interest and also expertise. And Mary Beth, like, we're so interested in your experience with, you know, death and dying and green funerals. Can you just tell us a little bit about, like, background on how you kind of got involved with that?
It probably goes back to the fact that, and this is... when I was first a nurse, I started in labor and delivery. So I was around birthing a lot. And I was very much involved with the movement to move birthing to birthing centers. I actually, for a short period of time, assisted a doctor who was doing home deliveries. And then I continued on my nursing career, became a nurse practitioner. And at some point, and my mom actually had a friend who was instrumental in bringing hospice to Long Island. Her name was Bea Greenbaum. And my mom took me to a speaking event about it, and I was just really drawn to it. So I was working part-time as a women's healthcare nurse practitioner and part-time as a per diem hospice nurse for a period of about 15 months. And I had really amazing experiences, but I also had two small kids, and it just wasn't functional to stay in that role for too long. So I let that go, but always felt in my heart I was going to go back to that work in some way or another. And then when my mom was obviously at the end of her days. For the last 11 days, I brought her into my home. I'm the oldest of six kids. And so at that point, I pulled out all the things that I had learned about how to make it the best experience possible for all of us. I even had have a friend who is a musical thanatologist, meaning somebody who uses music with the dying, who came and did a ritual with a harp at the bedside. And then when my mom actually died, I didn't even call the hospice nurse. I didn't call the funeral parlor. Like, I knew that we all wanted to be with her and surround her and have our last goodbyes. And so when I did, I asked the funeral home not to come for 6 hours. And I came to learn that that's called a delayed pickup, which I didn't know anything about that.
Right.
But, so my family all gathered and, we were sitting she was in the den, which is next to the deck to go outside. And it was in June. And so most of my family was sitting outside on the patio. We were eating a very traditional Irish meal of bagels and cream cheese and lox. And going in and each person would go in and sit with her for a little while. And then about an hour before the funeral people were to arrive, I gathered the women. There were about six of us. And we bathed my mom's body. We anointed her with oil. We combed her hair. We dressed her. We said our real goodbyes, and we had like blaring sacred music on, like Luciano Pavarotti singing Panis Angelicus.
Wow!
And it was just like I just got goosebumps just recalling how incredible it was. And then when the funeral people came, instead of them coming in, the men in the family carried her body out to the hearse.
Wow.
So powerful.
Incredible.
Yeah. And we had a several day funeral, and at the wake, even at the end, the last night of it, I went around with scissors and I was clipping the roses and the flowers off of all of the floral arrangements that everybody had sent, and gave everybody that was there a flower to cover her with petals and flowers in the casket.
Beautiful. It's, I'm actually want to go back to something you said almost offhandedly when you were describing this, was that you really researched and how to make it a beautiful experience for all of you, which I think is something that we don't really think about in the dying process or in the grieving process as important necessarily, right? Because it's so stigmatized and so kind of pushed away in our culture, that we don't think about that this can be a ritual. And so what you've described mm-hmm. is such a beautiful ritual. And I think we deprive ourselves of that. And especially as things become more and more sterilized and thinking about death is like somehow we need to get it away and out of the house. Like, we forget that making this a ritual that is satisfying and beautiful for the people around, as well as the person who's passing away, is deeply important and not something that you should feel, shame or guilt about, like that, oh, I'm making this an enjoyable experience for myself. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's almost people feel like they have to steal it because it's not owed to them. And then instead it's supposed to be a fearful, uptight, almost a corporate feeling. You know, a lot of funeral homes have that, such a stiff, corporate, scary feeling.
Yeah. That's all relatively new. If you think back even 100 years, this wasn't the way funerals were done. In other countries, it's not the way funerals are held. And there is a whole funeral industry, which is really being turned on its head these days with the increase of cremations, the outrageous costs. And so I think they're recognizing that they need to be more open and receptive to, and the change in people's religious backgrounds and beliefs are not you know, for some people, what was traditional in their family just isn't right anymore.
Totally. I have an interesting thing that I was reading earlier about kind of where this turnaround came with, you know, the sterilization of death in Western culture, at least. So this is written by an author in Great Britain and describing a little bit about where the change took place in British culture. And they say, the author says, the corpse had an ambiguous spiritual status. The care it received was thought somehow to influence the future life of the soul. Washing and cleansing not only the sweat of death, but the sins of earthly life, a sort of lay of absolution. A woman interviewed in 1980 in a Suffolk village told me, the washing is that so you're spotless to meet the Lamb of God. Obviously, this is from a Catholic perspective, but a change in attitude towards the corpse had begun to develop towards the end of the 19th century, probably as a result of the public health reformers' activities, whereby the older attitude of society towards the dead was supplemented, even suppressed, by the growing perception that dead bodies were unhygienic. This attitude emphasized the need to segregate the dead away from the living. For extra payment, undertakers began to offer wealthier people new facilities without the taint of public mortuary to store the dead away from their home. One undertaker has estimated that when he began working in 1936, 90% of bodies would be kept at home between the death and burial. Today, the figure is only about 5 to 10%. This significant change as customary behavior reveals something of a revolution in attitude towards the corpse, a new squeamishness, which means that many people accept the physical removal of the dead with relief, indeed seem to require it for their own psychological survival. I thought that was interesting.
Our experience as a family was that the process of having her not only die at home, but then to be witness and involved in the caretaking of her body really enhanced the process of knowing that she had died. Right. And that it's not like you want them back, because it was a process, and we watched the whole process unfold, and we watched the many changes that happened in her body as she got, you know, I think it's a blessing to have the ability, as long as someone's not in excruciating pain, to be witness to the dying process rather than a sudden death, because it puts closure on it, and it and the feedback that I got was that it was really very, very helpful in the grieving process. Yeah. To have done everything that we did. We really felt like we did everything we did. It's like, it's why I love how you call your counseling bittersweet, Bobby. Mm-hmm. Bittersweet grief counseling, because it is, it's bittersweet. It's not light. It's really intense. It's really deep. But it has this heart opening ability that other rituals can seem sterile and unfulfilling.
Exactly. And, you know, I also worked in hospice. And even now when I talk to people about their family members dying, I tell them in a way that you're accompanying them as far as you can. And what you're opening up to us now is the fact that it's even beyond their death, you can accompany them to their next journey, to where they go next.
Yeah,
and I think that's so important. You know, part of what you were saying is that funerals or whatever rituals we create are really a way of processing a lot of the tasks of grief. And we've talked on the show before about the different kinds of tasks that there are, you know, the first one being acknowledging the reality. And so there's something so powerful about going through the rituals. It helps you accept the reality more. And that's one of the tasks, the most important tasks of grief. And the other one is, like, you know, moving towards the pain. And as you're saying, it's a very deep experience. It's a very stirring experience that we're trying not to sterilize. And to, as Zara, that was such a good point about people's fear of the body. But we're also sterilizing the feelings as well. And so I think when you have these kinds of rituals, it really helps you do that. And then also remembering the person who has died is part of how we grieve. And so I imagine in all the stories that you were telling over your mom, as you prepared her and all the, it must have been so tender and so lovely. And that was really moving through so a lot of the tasks of that we do in our grieving process. So such a rich story. So how did that, where did you take this? How did this, where did you take this experience with your mom, which was, you say, in 2013?
It got me thinking that there, one piece that happened when we went to the gravesite was we chose to go barefoot to the gravesite. We were singing, there's this song, Tura Lura Lura, which is an Irish lullaby, not an Italian, an Irish lullaby that we were singing. And the people from the funeral home were annoyed. And they were like trying to get us to stop and leave. I guess maybe they had another case or I don't know what it was. Wow. But it was like, wow, it just didn't feel right. So I started to do research. And that's when I learned, first I learned of something called the Green Burial Council, because it also didn't feel right. Like, why embalm a body and pollute the earth and put them in maybe in a
$10,000 box?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to me, and it seemed, and we're running out of space, and so I wanted to learn about more. So I found this thing called the Green Burial Council, and through a that's about, it lists places that offer certified green burials, and in order to get certified as a green burial site, there are lots of regulations, like the casket. The body has to be in a natural, either a shroud or a cardboard box or wicker,
wicker
casket, something that's biodegradable.
Right.
And you can't have even any kind of toxic glue on it. They don't have tombstones. You could have a marker, like a stone or a marker, but it's supposed to be in a place to preserve also the land, so that the land then cannot be developed. So it serves that portion, that function as well. And then I was introduced, I reached out to a woman named Amy Cunningham, who is a holistic funeral director based in Brooklyn. And her journey was when she was in her 50s and her dad died. She was a writer in the natural movement, like about yoga and organic foods. And she was a New York Times writer. And so when her dad died, she created with her family a beautiful funeral. I think they had a Dixie style band, like from New Orleans.
Yeah.
And when she came back to New York, because I think it was in South Carolina, she said to her husband, I think I want to do this. And so in her 50s, she went to mortuary school.
Wow, how fascinating.
And went through all the hoops that you had to go through, including learning embalming, even though in her current practice, she doesn't do that. And she's now a leader, a beacon of light in this area for non-traditional funerals and green burials. And so we connected and we resonated. I even had her come to my house, and I was running something called Wellness Salons at that point. And she gave a talk on cremation and carbon footprints. And I learned that cremation actually has a higher carbon footprint than green burials, because of it requires very, very high temperatures for a prolonged period of time. And so we became friends, and a little while afterwards, she invited me to attend a training with a woman named Reverend Olivia Barham, who is based in LA but came to the East Coast. It was down in Baltimore, outside of Baltimore, and about 16 of us, and it's women again. It's most of these things are women driven.
Yeah.
And we spent 4 days learning how to oversee home funerals. And it was this integration of beautiful ritual. And it also addressed different types of rituals, like in Judaism, the kinds of rituals and funeral services already are really very pared down and organic in terms of carbon footprint. It's a lot less than the ornateness that a lot of other people go through. But we learned there's, I don't remember the name of it, but there's a particular way of washing the body. There's a certain number of people that are called together to wash the body in a ritualistic manner.
It's called the Felit. No, I'm sorry. It's called the...
I think it starts with a T. And then you tie the shrouds in different... There were certain knots that we had to learn how to tie the shrouds.
This was the Jewish method that you had learned, the Jewish history that you had learned?
She was teaching us a bunch of different tools and techniques. And Amy lives in Brooklyn. So her catchment area is generally New York City-ish, sometimes into Westchester. But it was only not last fall, but the fall after the one before that, where she called me up and said she had a home funeral, a request on Long Island, and would I be interested? And so that was my first opportunity, and
What was your job? What did you have to do?
Well, Amy, as the funeral director, was overseeing the whole scenario, and the person had died in a hospital, but the family wanted the body to be home with it with them for a couple of days, and it was a small family. There, as long as there is a funeral director that's willing to oversee it, it is legal in New York State to have home funerals. In other states, like in Baltimore and Maryland, where we were, the women down there were even transporting the bodies, like without licensure. They could bring the bodies. I'm okay with having the funeral director transport the body. That's okay with me. So she came. I was at the house, and I was there with the daughter and the husband. And when Amy and the funeral people came out from Brooklyn, and the mother was the deceased was in a beautiful wicker casket that was placed in the living room. And for that family, it was a very small, private affair. And
they just didn't want it to be in a hospital and didn't want it to be in a funeral home. What do you think motivated them to choose this?
They knew of Amy, and they were also had family scattered about, and they wanted an opportunity. They just liked the idea of it being simple and quiet.
Yes.
And the deceased stayed in the house for 3 days. And so my role was to be a support person and to go to the house every day with dry ice and replace the dry ice that the deceased was on and check to see that things were going right.
I have a question for you, Mary Beth, just knowing your professional background as a healthcare practitioner, especially in women's health and dealing a lot with people who are experiencing, coming to you and finding out they're pregnant or being with them throughout that process and that part of their life, and perhaps dealing with finding out that they have an illness, that could be like, I'm interested in how that connects to your interest in, green funerals and in afterlife care and being present in this way. Like, do you feel like that there's a connection in between that and seeing kind of a very raw look at the living process in general that makes you more, has opened you up to being kind of part of this
dying funeral process?
I think, yeah, it's a continuum, and I am comfortable. Nurses, I'm a nurse. I started in my early 20s in the process to become a nurse. Nurses have, since a very young, relatively young age, been exposed to situations, life and death situations, and are kind of trained and prepped to manage or be at peace with and be comfortable and be a support person. And I feel blessed that when I was trained as a nurse, that there was very much a holistic emphasis on the importance of being not just present for the physical caring, but also for the emotional, the psychological, the spiritual caring. And as I've evolved and moved through my own personal spiritual journey, and it's integrated with my practice as a holistic nurse, that to me, it feels like an enormous blessing to be able to hold these spaces and hold these containers for people to bear witness and like some kind of hold someone's hand,
yeah,
to allow them and to help them pull out the strength and the courage and to recognize the amazing opportunity that they could choose to partake and participate in something that we've been divorced from as a culture.
Yeah.
I mean, historically, living in Huntington, the Walt Whitman house that's across from the Walt Whitman Mall, yeah, has a room in it was the birthing and the deathing room. So people were born at home. They died at home. It was part of their lived journey, their lived experience. And I think there's a richness to it and an importance to it that we've thrown out, that it's time to reclaim. And a lot of people are wanting this.
Yeah, I think it's really beautiful. Bobby, you had talked about, I know you had done some research on some different kind of funeral and death traditions. Is there anything kind of that you can share with us about some of the research you did this week?
Actually, before I do that, I just want to point out, I was in hospice, and I was once introduced to somebody that later became one of my best friends, and she was a midwife. And the person that introduced us was a wonderful storyteller, Heather Forrest. And she brought us together under a chuppah because we met at a wedding. And she joined our hands and she said, Bobby, you spend so much time with the dying. Penny, you spend so much time with birthing. You two should know each other. And she put our hands together. We created the circle together. And I always thought of it, what you were talking about before, is that there's a process in all of that. There's a process in birthing. And there's times that are so terrifying, right? That are scary. It feels like it's never going to end, and the physical experience is so profound. And I think what we do as professionals, and what you do as a nurse, and I certainly in my work too, we provide a faith in the process, because many people are afraid in the dying process. And I noticed that in hospice, that in the beginning, so many people had so much fear, and I felt like my job was to hold the faith in the process. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what I heard you say before, but just to answer your questions, Mary Beth was talking about it before, that different cultures have different rituals. And I grew up, my mom grew up as an Orthodox Jew, and she had promised my brother, she had promised him that when she died, that he would be able to follow through with the Orthodox method, because later in life, wasn't religious. And so there are certainly Jewish traditional services which are more like any other service. But the Orthodox service is very specific. And you were describing some of it before. It has to do with shrouds and shawls. And there's also somebody that watches the body You know, it has to watch it from the moment that they die to the moment that they're buried. And they pay people to do that. Sometimes it's family and sometimes it's not. Sometimes they pay somebody.
What is the significance of that? Do we know? I mean, I'm sure.
I think they're watching. I believe that they're kind of just watching over the soul so that it's cared for and tended to, you know, all the way through the process. And then the other part thing about the Jewish service is that the family members are the ones that put the earth on the casket. So they themselves are the ones that take handfuls of dirt and throw it onto the casket so that they're part of the process. But, you know, I did research a lot of different cultures, but I'm also more curious to hear, did you do any more of this home funerals? Do you have any other experiences?
I did. I did one more about 2 weeks after the first one, which it's so unusual for that to, you know, but clumped together like that was amazing. Amy called me again, and there was another family that was preparing for a home funeral. They would call her in advance, and, you know, and so we were waiting for another matriarch of the family to die. And this one was just the on the other end of the spectrum from the first one, which was very quiet and private. This was an incredibly loving, large, blended Japanese American family that owns the matriarch who passed owned a restaurant locally in our town, and had two daughters and a son and all of their extended family that really went to great lengths to provide an unbelievably, incredibly beautiful experience. They had purchased a simple coffin from a pine box, but it was carved that they had already. So they put that together, and they and she was at home when she passed. So they set up the coffin next to her and dressed her in a kimono. And one of the things that happened is the matriarch had been ill for a really long time and had Parkinson's and had different neurological illnesses that caused her always to have like her face was kind of scrunched and unhappy looking. I didn't see that because I only saw her after she had passed, but everybody kept commenting on how beautiful and serene her face looked and how much of a contrast it was from what they had been witnessing during the time of her illness.
And it wasn't embalming. It was
at home on ice, on the dry ice. And they put beautiful navy blue fabric that had like chrysanthemum print all around the periphery of the casket, and filled it with boughs of flowers. And one of the daughters is a florist, and they had incense burning, and somebody who sat next to her praying. Going back and reflecting, Bobby, my experience is, this is just the ones that I've been present for, is that people really know that this is like this is your last visit with this body. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a great motivation to just sit with it. Mm-hmm. Even if that's somebody was present with her for that whole time. Mm-hmm. And that was another 3-day event where they stayed with her. And they had a big, it was open to family, friends, and they had a ceremony at the house. And it was just exquisite.
Again, accompanying her on the process.
I want to just mention a counterpoint, which is that I obviously am in, well, maybe not obviously, but I am in alignment with everything we're talking about, right? And the thought of being able to have this kind of ceremony and ritual is so appealing to me in a way. But when my dad died, he died in the hospital and I was alone. I had no support with me. I'm an only child. He didn't have anyone else. And my dad died in the hospital and I went in and there was a sheet over his body and they didn't even tell me that they said he wasn't going to be in there and he'd already been moved. And I went in and there was a sheet over his body and his arm was hanging out and I was terrified and I walked out and that was the last time I ever saw him. So while we're talking about this stuff and perhaps even some of our listeners are listening to this and they're like, God, this sounds so amazing. I didn't do that, you know, and even thinking about this, I'm having all this regret and being like, oh, I didn't do this, but this is where my heart is. This is the kind of person I am. This is what I would have wanted to do. I just want to offer something to other people who might be listening to this and feeling guilt or some kind of shame around not doing something like this and reminding you that being able to plan something like this also requires support. And a lot of people lose people when they're all alone, like myself, for instance, I had zero support. And I'm sure a lot of other people are in the same boat. And you kind of are just okay, this thing is happening now, this thing is happening now, this thing is happening. So I just want to quickly acknowledge that being able to have a ceremony like this, which is so gorgeous and so ideal and so wonderful, and Mary Beth, the work you're doing in this capacity you've done in the past is so beautiful. And Bobby, as a hospice nurse, it's so beautiful. But I just wanted to offer a little space for people who, even when someone isn't just ripped away suddenly, even when my dad was sick for 10 years, you know what I mean? So it wasn't a surprise, but it still can happen so quick. And if you don't have the support, you can, you know, you might not have the opportunity.
Absolutely. I love that you always bring in that the other way of looking at something. And you're so right, Sarah. The words in my mind was support. But it's not just family support. It's also the system. And I'm so glad to hear that the system is changing.
Yeah.
Because... you know, I'm also going to add, I had a similar experience, not similar, but a very devastating experience when my mother was buried. Devastating. And part of the reason was because we weren't all on the same page. Mm. You know, again, my brother, you know, rest his soul, was Orthodox and had very rigid, prescribed ways of how it to be done. And I had so much spirit inside when she died, and I really wanted to bring that spirit to the table. There was no room. There was no room. So some families, you know, are very structured, and there's no room for people that want to express themselves in the family.
So I think you brought up a really good point. Sometimes it can just happen so quickly.
Absolutely.
Even when it doesn't happen quickly. And you know, part of the thing that is unspoken here, but we have to acknowledge, I think, is that because of the, you know, capitalist society that we live in, the death industry is an industry like meant every other industry, and it's designed to get you to move quickly in this specific way, and then you move to this thing, you move to this thing. So it's a wonderful it's a wonderful alternative that we're talking about today to be able to illuminate people to the fact that, you know, A, this exists. I feel like for a lot of folks, I'm glad we're doing this with you, Mary Beth, because I feel like a lot of folks aren't even aware that this is an option. And when they're aware that's an option, there's a kind of a learning curve almost, and being like, oh, this is an option. Could I do this? You know what I mean?
But remember one other important thing. What about the person who died? They have very often the person who's dying. We're starting to ask them, what do you want? What kind of things do you have in mind? Sometimes they plan their own rituals and ceremonies, They're part of it too.
Mm. Yeah. So it's a very interesting kind of thing, but I think the thing that is a really the biggest point that we can grasp onto here is remembering that death does not have to be sickness to hospital, to casket, to funeral home, to embalming fluid. It can be. It certainly can be if that's something that you and your family and your loved one wants, who amongst us are to say that's wrong, but it certainly doesn't have to be. And I think the earlier we can kind of get on the page of being like, wow, I could sit with the body of my loved one in my home for a couple of days and take that in and process it. I could create ritual around that. That's something that is normal and natural. Like, you know, how would that feel for me? And start thinking about it. I wish I had thought about that earlier. honestly, I wish I had made myself comfortable with that thought, because I would have loved to have the opportunity to have a ritual around my dad's death and to see his body. Because of the society we live in, it didn't ever even occur to me. I didn't even want to go there. And I am someone who is clearly willing to go there, you know? And so even for me, it was hard. So I hope, I'm really glad that we're having this talk so that people can kind
of... Well, it's empowering. What we're talking about is this conversation is hopefully empowering people. And it doesn't necessarily have to be with the dying or the immediate death of a person. Sometimes it's in the way we honor that they're passing afterwards. So whether it's the way, if with your dad's death, I remember I came down after he died, and we together, in a very sacred space, created rituals that I imagine we never dreamed we would have done.
Yeah.
It was in the moment. We just both were inspired and we supported each other in it. And so it doesn't, sometimes you don't have the opportunity when somebody dies in a hospital and you really have to fit in with the system and the rules and regulations. But I guess this conversation is to empower everyone to try to let their spirit come through, even if it's opening the window. You know, I had learned right after my mom died, somebody reminded me that after somebody dies, you open the window. And I did it when she died. It was so special to me, just in the hospital, the terrible way she died in an emergency room. It was a horrible death. But opening the window, I just felt like her spirit went out the window, and it was a little teeny moment. So it wasn't the beautiful things that Mary Beth was describing, but for me in that little moment. So we can find those little moments.
I think it's also important to contextualize this, that we're maybe at the kind of end, but we're in a pandemic right now, and COVID has totally flipped the switch in terms of how people have been able to be and not be present with their loved ones in death. And there's been a lot of creativity around that that people that are interested in enriching the process have come up with of new ways of honoring in a very challenging time. A lot of people have had that experience recently where they were not able to be present even as the person was dying, and the whole, forget about the funerals have been
exactly
shifted. So there can be more creative ways of, but it is about going inside and figuring what could bring us meaning, and how can we as a family or even as an individual honor this person's legacy.
I was thinking of the Rolling Stones. I was thinking about, you don't always get what you want. Sometimes you try to get what you need, you know?
Yeah, and that was my dad. That is how John taught me about music. I remember I was a little kid and I must have been 8. And he was like, well, this is going to be your biggest life lesson. And he put on that song. And I read it at his funeral. Guys, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about some different funeral food traditions from around the world.
This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese. Forever Cheese has been a pioneer in the specialty food industry for over 20 years. They source the most exceptional, authentic, and creative artisan cheese and accompaniments from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia. Every product they carry is thoughtfully hand-selected from their trusted producers in Europe. The standards of Forever Cheese are legendary. Many of their products, including Drunken Goat, Genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mitica Marcona Almonds, and Fig and Date Cakes, are now integral to today's market. You can learn more about their product lineup at forevercheese.com. Forever Cheese is proud of their role as a trusted authority in the specialty cheese world. Their philosophy is to put passion behind everything they do, from finding the best products to celebrating those who make them. Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Thanks to Forever Cheese for supporting this episode. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
All right, so we're back with Mary Beth White. And guys, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about, for the food kind of element of the show, and since we were talking about funerals, I was interested to kind of research some different food traditions from around the globe that people do when they're kind of, I don't know, I want to say celebrating a funeral. I know that's a weird way of putting it, but it's just what popped into my head. And I think in a way, as we learned from Mary Beth, it really can be a celebration. So I'm just going to mention a couple and we can kind of talk through them. But in Mexico, translating to bread of the dead, they have sweet rolls. Oh, I want to mention, I got most of this information from an article in the Daily Mail. To celebrate the Day of the Dead, they make these rolls that are baked in Mexico for the Day of the Dead festival in November when Mexicans commemorate their loved ones. The soft, sweet bread rolls can vary according to regional recipes and are sometimes shaped like animals or people with colorful decorations. So they make these gorgeous, beautiful rolls and they're decorated like the loved ones. And I'd love to do a whole episode kind of about the Day of the Dead because what an incredible.
I think you should.
Yeah, what an incredible celebration. This is a really beautiful one. In Japan, Japanese Buddhists hold a memorial festival called Obon, where spirits of loved ones are thought to visit from the afterlife. Families often make food offerings to their ancestors on Buddhist altars in their homes. One custom is to carve or model a cucumber to represent the shape of a horse, known as the Koyuri Uma. Families leave these on their loved ones' graves to help them return to the afterlife when Obon ends. Eggplants often represent cows, known as Nasu Ushi.
Mm.
Yeah, that was a cool one. Mormons, as many of us know, have a tradition of funeral potatoes, as our mutual friend and former guest on this show, Kathy Bodily, has told us about in Utah. And, you know, Mormons outside of Utah, but often bring funeral potatoes, which is some kind of potato casserole. Do you guys know anything about this?
I just know that they talk about it all the time.
Right.
It's just like a really, it's as common as the potato, right?
It's very common. Mormon funeral potatoes are traditional casserole commonly served after a funeral. The all-American dish involves cubed potatoes, cheese, onions, cream sauce, and is topped with cornflakes or potato chips, which is kind of the signature thing that makes them funeral potatoes. But yeah. This one I also really, really, really loved. In Korea, food is a significant part of Korean funerals. During the ritual, the person who has died is offered bowls of rice and 3 spoonfuls are placed inside their mouth. For those attending the funeral and paying their respects, traditional Korean dishes like yuca jjajang are served. Yuca jjajang is a spicy beef soup containing scallions, bean sprouts, garlic, sweet potatoes, and chili. It's a traditional dish that is often served at funerals with a bowl of rice and kimchi. Mary Beth, I don't know if you know about this, but have you heard of Irish wake cake?
I do not.
Apparently in Ireland, they always have something called Irish wake cake. From what I've read, and this makes sense, just what we know sometimes happens at Irish funerals is there's a lot of drinking. I think this food is specifically... made to soak up some of the alcohol as this is what I've read in articles. I don't want to create too much of a stigma around Irish funerals, but, in Estonia, after the last shovel of dirt hits the coffin, the mourning family serves up pastries, bread, and vodka at the gravesite. Anything left over is abandoned at the cemetery. To bring it home would only invite more death into the house. Later that day, more substantial funeral feast is served at the home of the deceased, including cabbage rolls, always, Bobby. So stuffed cabbage, which was traditional food in our family growing up. In Great Britain, they bury people with a ham, and they call it being buried with a ham. So a lot of people have been buried. They bury people with foods, and ham is a very traditional thing to be buried with.
That's an interesting choice.
I know, ham. in Hawaii, centuries ago, Hawaiians were customarily wrapped in banana, taro, and mulberry leaves before being buried near the community dining room. Earmarked for men, a laulau is a popular item in Hawaiian funeral feasts. It's a serving of spicy pork, chicken, or vegetables wrapped in taro leaves and then steamed or prepared in a pressure cooker. And it's often used filled with spam.
Spam?
Well, yeah, spam is very popular in Hawaii, right. In Hawaiian culture. Right. Like, it's very, very, like, it's ubiquitous to Hawaiian culture. Spam is everywhere.
Wow.
In Romania, after a relative dies, Romanian families prepare enough loaves of ring-shaped bread named colaci to accompany the coffin in a procession from the home to the church to the graveyard. At the cemetery, relatives pass the colaci, a black hen, a candle, a crock of water, and a chunk of salt back and forth over the open grave. Afterward, they are placed nearby as payment for the gravedigger.
Mm.
And then I have one more. In Vietnam, food plays a big role in the funeral. To prepare the deceased for their journey at the wake, the mouth is kept open so the visitors can drop grains of rice in. Mm. Mourners bring a bowl of rice to place on top of the coffin so that by the end of the wake, there will be so much weight on top that the devil will not be able to get into the coffin. On the 49th and 100th day after the death, the family gathers to remember the deceased with a special meal. Bun ho often fits the bill.
Wow.
So those are a couple of really interesting and beautiful rituals surrounding death involving food.
And some based on, I don't even want to use the word superstition because I don't mean that exactly, but you know, the beliefs that cultures have about what happens when we die, because nobody knows.
So yeah,
we've created all kinds of stories of what, you know, what we believe. And so it's so interesting that some of these things fit right into their belief system about what happens after somebody dies. And they tie the food in. It's really incredible.
And I think superstition has a negative connotation to it, but really, I mean, who cares if you have a superstition, if you have a belief in something that we can't see? I mean, you know, religion could be looked at as superstition. It's all about,
it's based on the unknown. Yeah.
And your idea and your family or your culture's idea of, you know, what makes sense to you and believing in something we can't see, I think we have to all kind of respect that. I think to destigmatize superstition is important.
Actually, you know, your point is so well taken, because that's exactly what we've been talking about today, really, is that the deep beliefs that we have, we're trying to figure out the meaning of life and death, you know, all of us to some extent, certainly when somebody dies. And we have to trust some of the beliefs that we have that make sense to us. And sometimes we can do them individually because families don't want to join us. But sometimes we can engage, as you did, Mary Beth, you engaged your family in certain beliefs and feelings that you had. And you invited them to join you, and it felt so comfortable for them. But for those where it's not comfortable for the family, do it anyway. Find ways to... I remember at my mother's burial, I had my own little secret little things that I didn't share with anybody else. I did my own rituals because they didn't fit in with the formal rituals of the family. I just did it on my own. And I didn't care. No one was going to stop me, but I didn't have to push it on anybody.
Well, also, here's the thing, right? That... These rituals are largely for the living. And I think we kind of started out saying this, Mary Beth, when you were talking about making this an enjoyable and special experience for, you know, everybody. And I think, like, you know, if we're going to go ahead and say, look at the tradition of putting, you know, rice in someone's mouth so that they're fed or whatever that may be in any different culture, like, we don't know, right? We do know that that person doesn't have a voice in whether or not that's helpful. And we're actually not sure about whether any of these things will help them in the afterlife. What we do know is it's satisfying our soul. It's feeding our soul. It's feeding our image of what may or may not happen to this person after they die. And it's important for someone who's still living their life to feel in some way that they've put this person they cared about on their best path into whatever may be, you know,
and it's honorable,
important
passage,
to us. So while it may seem as like, you know, we're covering the dead in a shroud, or we're putting this many scoops of dirt on the grave, or we leave this so that they're not hungry when they go, or we open the window, or we close the window, you know, it's really like about us. And for instance, to go back to what I was talking about myself, about not being able to do that for my dad and feeling guilty. Like I, you know, like he's in my mind either way, you know what I mean? Kind of the same. And I, since I didn't get it then, and a lot of people who didn't get it then, or even who did get to do things, but have regret, you can still do this. Just as grief is kind of a lifelong process, so is the ritual surrounding letting go. It doesn't have to be confined to this specific mm-hmm. time. You can do this at any time if you want, because it's really about you.
It's a good point.
I'd like to just intersect something that feels appropriate to say at this point, where especially having been a hospice nurse, that and talking about how a lot of the things that we do are for us and not the dying person or the person who's deceased, that one of the things that families struggle with so much at the very end is the fact that the person who is in the active dying process is withdrawn and is no longer taking in food, no longer eating. And that can become very conflictual and very traumatic for families, because they often don't know what their role is. If they're not able to feed a person or give the person something to drink, like what's important? And it's part of the role of somebody who's a hospice nurse or a doula or somebody who's aware of the process is to educate the family that it's part of the process. And the less fluids and food that the person takes in at the end, the easier it is, because they don't have they won't have as liquidy cough. There's actually endorphins that are released through the process of not having food. And so it's important to reframe that what is important is the presence of the person being with the person who's passing, and knowing that they still potentially might hear that could be the last sense that goes. And so telling them they love them and thanking them, and it is as important as giving them food and drink. And it's such a struggle for some families.
You do it
and
for
it
them.
Can cause it can cause people to choke and and make it
people,
a lot
people feel
harder.
Like eat for me, you know, eat for me, stay here for me. And that's
a moment
you
realize
really struggle.
That's a really, really, really great point, Mary Beth. And it's almost like mom sometimes talk about this, especially in the kind of codependent nature of, you know, family members, which is not always a negative thing, but I'm cold, why don't you put on a coat kind of thing. And maybe it's an interesting kind of point to think about, like, oh, I really want to feed this person because, you know, it's what I feel like I can do to be useful. And maybe to redirect that, and not to say that you can always eat if you're upset, but maybe if you're with a dying loved one and you want to feed them or give them water, but they don't actually want it, or it's, as you're saying, Mary Beth, not helpful for them, maybe you need to drink some water. Maybe you need to eat something and see how that feels, to redirect that energy towards yourself. If you're also not in a place where you're feeling like eating and drinking, because I know for myself, when I'm upset, sometimes it's the last thing I want. But what is the thing you can maybe give to yourself that would feel nourishing? If that's your compulsion and it's not good for the other person, how do you give that maybe to yourself or someone else in your family, you know, a not dying person?
You know, I think that actually, you know, the whole process of watching and helping somebody die in our journey and the burial, it's really for both. It goes back and forth, and you have to kind of notice that subtle difference between when it's for them and when it's for you. And I think even many people feel that the services they provide are for them, for the dying, to let their soul, as I was saying before, to take care of their soul as it leaves, you know. So it's a back and forth. I feel like this conversation could go on. I think we should have another
A part two
discussion.
Yes. I love that.
I wanted to bring up something, and I'm not going to discuss it now, but just put it out there for anybody that's really interested in the subject. HBO, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, did a documentary called Alternative Endings, 6 New Ways to Die in America. It was wonderful. I remember being blown away.
I can't wait to watch that.
And they talked about different ways that family members, unique ways, like a sea burial. And somebody had a space burial where they sent the ashes up to space. They talked about green burials. They also talked about people that assisted suicide. and I don't even like to use that word. They use, actually called it medical aid in dying, which is a much better way. And they talked about celebrations of life, where you have the celebrations similar in Dick Johnson is Dead, the movie that we discussed, where you have the celebration of life before, you know. So there's so much to talk about here. Mary Beth, we love you so much, and this has been a joy.
It's been a pleasure.
So good. I have two books I want to recommend, actually, too, based on some of the things I talked about. There's a book called Being Dead is No Excuse, which is incredible.
That's a good title.
It is. Hang on. I just want to look up the author quickly. It's by Gaydon Metcalf. It's great. It was recommended in the HRN studios, actually, by the incoming, I forget her name, but the incoming editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine was going to be interviewed by someone on HRN, and then we were going in next, and she mentioned it, and I bought it, and it's incredible. And then the other book that I want to recommend, where I got some of this information for my little segment, is called Death Warmed Over. By Lisa Rogak, and it is about death food celebrations and culture, how different cultures around the world celebrate death through food. So those are
two kind of cool books. Wow. Mary Beth, is there anything about anything that you would like to share with people in terms of how they can find out more about
I would recommend the Green Burial Council, and also Amy Cunningham's website, Fitting Tribute. I think it's called theinspiredfuneral.com.
Okay, we'll put a link to it.
It has lots of information about how to create services and rituals and memorials.
Great.
I found
something called funeralwise.com, which had an amazing amount of information about this. I would strongly advise that as well. We have a special ritual that we do on processing, and we like to think that we've had meals with you, shared wonderful meals with you before. But right now, this has been such a lovely, warm connection, and we'd like to think if we could sit down to a meal right now, what would we each bring so that we could kind of visualize our celebration together. So anybody have any ideas?
This minute?
Yeah. Well, let's say later today we're going to have dinner, and it was summertime and we're at Bobby's backyard.
Does it have to be summertime? Can I bring Bobby's soup? Because Bobby's soup.
Bobby! Another person mentioning your soup. That must mean that it's good.
Nourished me through a lot lately. It's to know when it's in my refrigerator just makes me very happy.
Oh, that's so sweet, Mary Beth. It's my vegetable soup that I have bestowed on you many times because Zara and I talk about what it's like when somebody you love and somebody you care about is hurting. And for those of us that food is one way we express ourselves, every time I know you're going through something, I just want to do something. And so I bring you minestrone soup. Okay, so we'll have some minestrone soon.
I'll bring a baguette from Caputo's, because Caputo's bakery in my neighborhood recently started making baguettes, and they make great Italian bread, and I would have never thought they're baguettes. I mean, it's baguette and Italian bread, they're, you know, very different things. They make the most delicious baguettes I've ever had outside of France, and so I would bring some Caputo's baguettes and some Kerrygold butter to, like, slather on and then dunk in the soup.
Yeah, I'm going to bring one piece of brownie that I have in my freezer that Zara made me for Mother's Day. It was a dark cocoa peanut butter swirl brownie. And I gave some to Kathy. We had a little tea party, and I took one piece and I put it in the freezer. So it's enough for the three of us to share. So
that's what it is. Very rich.
That's a meal.
Okay.
Amazing. That sounds great. I can't wait. Mary Beth, this was really beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us. What a cool, wonderful, fun, great thing. You're such as I started off by saying, but just, you know, when we think about community, which I think is, you know, becoming more and more scarce, unfortunately, but hopefully maybe we can turn a corner after, you know, the year and a half that we've had with realizing how important community is. But in our community, which I feel very lucky that we have, you are just such an important pillar in it, and such a healer and a wise human and a interesting human, and someone who I also will say, and Dan is much like you in this way is that you're constantly learning and learning new things and educating yourself about different kind of interesting things in your field and beyond. And this is a beautiful way to learn, a beautiful new thing to have learned about. And thank you so much for sharing it with us and our listeners. It's really, really cool.
I'll reflect that back and how you and your mom have turned a crisis of this whole pandemic into this ability to build a community through a forum that is we're all getting more and more used to these Zoom meetings, but I really feel you set the stage for just deepening the connection with and expanding it, your love out. Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
And one more special thank you. Thank you for having the best kid in the world. Two of the best kids, but particularly Dan, who is my best friend. And happy birthday to you, too, because when it's your kid's birthday, it's also your birthday. And they are a spectacular person. Dan, if you're listening, we all love you so much. Happy birthday.
Yay.
Yay.
Happy all right. birthday, Mom and Dan. We'll talk to you later. Back again soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.